All right, we are back. 20 VC with me, Harry Stebbings. And if you have not checked out our episode on Monday with Nikolai, founder at Revolut, that is a must. But now we are joined by yet another very, very special unicorn founder. He scaled his company with just $1.4 million in funding to over $140 million in ARR and a $5 billion valuation. Have you guessed it? Well, I'm thrilled to welcome Wade Foster, co-founder and CEO at Zapier, to the hot seat. Zapier is the company that moves info between your web apps automatically, so you can focus on your most important work. As I mentioned, post-YC in 2012, Wade raised $1.4 million for the company from Bessemer and Threshold, but since that round, he scaled the company to $140 million in ARR and a $5 billion valuation without any traditional-style venture rounds happening until earlier this year, when Sequoia and Steadfast bought out some early investors at the $5 billion reported valuation. I'd also want to say a huge thank you to Jay Simons at Bond, Shishir at Coda, and Vlad at Webflow. Some amazing question suggestions today. Really did make such a difference. But before we move into the episode today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just starting out or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Learn more at carta.com. And finally, I've always been a massive history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more VC funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that are bound to arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check them out at CooleyGo.com. But that's quite enough of me, so now I'm very, very excited to hand over to the one and only Wade Foster, co-founder and CEO at Zapier.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Wade, it is such a joy to have you on the show today. For a long time, I've wanted to do this one, but thank you so much for joining me again today.
Yeah, happy to be back, Harry.
Now, for those that maybe missed our first episode, tell me, how did you make your way into the world of startups, and how did you come to found the unicorn that is... Now, I always fuck this up. Zapier or Zapier? Help me out here.
Zapier makes you happier is the trick.
Zapier makes you happier. So how did you come to form Zapier and come to where we are today?
Yeah, so I graduated college during the financial crisis in 08. I was a good student, engineering major, not like crazy ambitious though. Like, I wasn't very career minded, I guess, in that regard. And so I just sort of expected, like, hey, I'm a good student. Like, I'll just go to the career fair and, like, I'm sure someone will hire me. And turned out during the financial crisis, that was not true. People were not just giving offers to, like, you know, fine students left and right. It was a bit of a wake up call. And I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do then? And I remember finding a small software company in the city that I lived in that was 5-6 people, and they were hiring a marketing intern. And I was like, well, I don't really know much about marketing, but, like, I'd read some stuff about AdWords and, like, was like, well, this is actually kind of cool. There's, like, more math behind this. Like, you can better understand, like, performance behind this stuff. So maybe I can talk my way into doing this. And they, for whatever reason, hired me. And getting to work there, like, the company was not a great startup, I guess, but it had a lot of really good people in it. And so I was able to learn a whole bunch about a bunch of different things. And I fell in love with building software. From that experience, I was like, I want to build a SaaS company someday. I want to build software someday. I didn't know what it would be, who it would be with, didn't know how I'd get it done. I didn't know how to code. Like, there's a whole bunch of I didn't knows that sort of came after that, but that's sort of where it started. And I just sort of kept trying to build new skills, get to know new people in the space, and, like, one thing led to another, and sort of Zapier popped out the other side.
Man, I've got to ask you a couple of things. Do you agree, and I oscillate between the two here, do you agree with the fake it till you make it? You know, you didn't know anything about marketing, really. Like, do you agree with the fake it till you make it theory?
I think one of the things that I know about myself is that I'm a pretty good learner. Like, I've always been able to sort of pick up on things pretty quickly. And so I generally try not to fake it in areas where I know I'm, like, woefully inadequate. But in areas where I'm like, you know, I think I have a knack for this, I generally will sort of, like, say yes to those opportunities. And then, like, no, I'm going to have to, like, dive in and learn a bunch of stuff out the gate and get going on it. And that sort of served me well. I think, you know, anyone that's built a company of any size realizes realizes that, like, you're going to have to be in this sort of state of perpetual learning and constant learning because, you know, as you keep growing, you're going to find out there's just yet another thing that you're not good at and don't know it about. So I do think there is some truth to it. I wouldn't, I guess, encourage people to fake being a doctor if they're not a doctor or something like that. But I do think, like, if you are good at learning things and, like, have an appetite and are curious about a thing, like, go ahead and say yes to a stretch opportunity here or there.
Yeah, I knew I shouldn't have lied about being a surgeon.
Yeah, generally not going to go well, I don't think.
And then the final one I have to ask on the background is just, like, you know, you mentioned there about the learnings from that company. I have a lot of graduates say to me, hey, I don't know what I should do. Should I join a big company and learn from a big company organization like a Stripe or a Zapier? Should I join a startup and really just do everything jack of all trades? Or should I just dive in and start my own? How do you advise, I know it's generic, but how do you advise graduates when they ask you that?
Well, if you want to learn how to run a company, I think the smaller company you can be a part of, the better, because you're just going to get exposed to, like, the whole of the thing. Because, you know, for me in that org, like, I got to be a part of product management. I got to be a part of building features. I got to be a part of running payroll. I got to be a part of hiring. I got to be a part of marketing. I got to be a part of sales and business development. And, like, we even wrote grants for the government to try and raise funds. So, like, all these different things, like, I got to be a part of them. Now, we weren't necessarily great at all those things. And in fact, that's perhaps why the company wasn't an amazing thing, but I got to experience it all. I knew coming out of it, I just had my worldview had been opened much wider than it was going in. And so I knew going into any company I would have ever started, I was like, here's what all the pieces are. I may not be an expert at any one of these things, but I know what all the pieces are. Whereas I think if you go to any sort of, like, post-product market fit company, you generally get slotted into, like, a role. And I think a sufficiently ambitious, smart person can still find ways to learn and have that sort of impact, but it's just not going to be there as naturally, I guess.
I do want to ask that, you know, the incredible thing about Zapier, well, there's many incredible things, but, you know, topic du jour is obviously remote work. And I hear so many interviews and they just give, like, the most BS answers to, like, what makes remote work successful. So I'm really interested when you think about, like, what specifically you do or did when it comes to remote work that allowed you to succeed. What do you think those would be?
I think it comes down to a few things. One, at the end of the day, working remotely is not so different than working in an office in that people want to feel like they have autonomy, mastery, purpose, like those things from, like, the book Drive is, like, Daniel Pink stuff, like, still applies. You're just still trying to, like, how do you give that in a slightly different environment? And a big part of that stems from management and leaders. Like, if you have great management, great leaders, they're going to be able to sort of help set up these systems and structures in a way that are going to be effective. Now, sure, you don't sit around a coffee table or a conference room table, you sit on Zoom. Sure, you should probably lean to more asynchronous work rather than synchronous work. But, you know, you're probably going to have to work more on, like, camaraderie and community building in a distributed team. You can't rely on the cafeteria room and the kitchens and stuff like that. So there's things that are like, okay, the default setting in a remote is going to maybe be harder in these dimensions and easier in these dimensions. So I think it just really boils down to, like, identifying, like, okay, these are the things that are going to be a little harder, and we're just going to have to be a little more intentional about those things versus actually we have a bit of an advantage now in some of these other areas, so maybe we get some of the benefit there. But at the core, like, I feel like building companies is still building companies. Like, it's still a lot of the things you do are still the same.
Okay, you know? So let's unpack that a little bit, because I also spoke to our mutual friend Shashir at Coda, and he said when it comes to staff meetings, often, you know, it's the core of a lot of kind of organizational infrastructure. How do you specifically run your staff meetings today? How do you determine who comes, the materials, the content?
Yeah. You know, at Zapier, we, like, the exec team has a staff meeting every week. There's a prompt ahead of time that tees up the topics. And so people sort of pre-fill out their documents. Folks join a Zoom for the meeting. We do 10 minutes of pre-read. We're in a Google Doc. So everyone's, like, commenting out to the right. And a lot of small stuff sort of just gets cleaned up in that first 10 minutes where it's like, you know, someone from engineering had this thing with someone in marketing and they're like, okay, we should do XYZ. And so, like, we never have to, like, talk aloud about those issues because they just sort of get taken care of in the comment section. Then for, like, the rest of the 50 minutes of the exec team, there's usually two or three, like, major topics. Maybe it's, like, a really key decision. Maybe there's, like, a strategic thing that we're trying to deal with. Maybe there's, like, a cultural issue that we're trying to address. Like, it can sort of span a few different areas, but then we sort of designate the rest of that 50 minutes to one of those big topics. And it's usually just one or two topics that get like the lion's share of the discussion in a given week. And then anything that sort of falls below that line goes back into Slack as an asynchronous discussion after the meeting. So it's like, hey, we didn't get to this thing. Talk about it here in async or in Slack asynchronously and sort of unblock yourself. However you need to unblock yourself, figure it out.
Can I ask, how do you think about accountability with those follow-up tasks? I'm always wary of accountability tied to two people, not one person. How do you approach that?
You know, I'll be honest, like we're not super great at this. I tend to say, you know, because we've intentionally put them below the like priority list, I don't worry about them all that much. Like I kind of take the mindset of like, well, if it was really important, it would have been like the number one thing we were spending our time on. And the fact that it wasn't, I personally am not going to drive a lot of accountability for those things below the line. Now, the exec team, if they like feel that it is important, they're free to go do that and drive on that. But it doesn't come from me. It comes from them on those things that are sort of quote unquote below the line. I don't know if that's ideal or not. Like, I think there's times when that's bit me, but we've also like not wasted a bunch of time on other things too. So like, it's just sort of a trade-off that I think we make.
I totally get you. And it allows for the focus in those meetings. When we think about like the decisions and the outcomes of those meetings, then they're communicated throughout the team and transparency is crucial, especially in remote teams more so than ever. When we think about like specific tooling, Jay Simons asked this one. He asked, what specific tools do you use to be as transparent as possible? And how do you communicate inside the company, specifically on communication?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of big company comm stuff tends to go through two channels. We built this tool, Async, internally that is like a, I mean, the best way to describe it is kind of like a Reddit style, but long form Reddit, I guess, where you can post blog posts and assign them like into a category or like maybe subreddit if you want to. And then, you know, people can sort of like and comment on those things. And, you know, stuff that gets like a certain amount of activity goes to like the homepage. And so the homepage is kind of where things are buzzing about. And then otherwise people create these little feeds that help them get insight into their like personal worldview of Zapier. So if you're an engineer, it's like, okay, I care about these engineering topics. And maybe like this specific product team is like adjacent to me, so I care about their stuff. And then maybe I'm going to subscribe to Wade and maybe the VP of engineering, so I'm going to see everything that they see. So you kind of can craft your own little like homepage experience that is specific to you. And so that is like the sort of main like company comms, external stuff. Then a lot of the more just like tactical nitty gritty, like day-to-day work just happens inside of Slack. So we have tons of channels that are in Slack. They follow a naming convention and you'll find people talking about this line of code or like this blog post that's going out or this support ticket, you know, very tactically in there inside of little Slack threads.
Can I ask, when you look at like the number of channels that you have and bluntly the sheer amount of volume that's posted, it's how big is the team today?
A little over 400 people today.
Okay, so over 400 people. Can I ask, where were the biggest breakpoints in the scaling of the org?
You know, I think we have had breakpoints at a few spots. I remember the first one was probably around 20 or 25. Like that was where it was like, oh my God, there's no like management structure in this company. And we needed to like instill sort of proper management best practices. And so that was like a big step function. And I remember like somewhere between like 100, 125 or so, kind of like the Dunbar's number where it was like, oh man, like I don't know everybody super well anymore. Like I know a lot of people, but not all folks really well. And like you started to have some of those people who were your first managers started to realize like, oh, managing like really big groups of people is its own skill set and started to have some challenges around that. So you started to bring in like a new set of executive leaders. And, you know, I think that spanned us pretty well, like 150 or 200 to about where we're at today, 400. I feel like we're kind of at starting to get to a little bit of another inflection point where we're sort of having to reset some of how our operating cadence works, like how our management structure works yet again. So like I'd say 30, 100, 300 kind of seem to be like the few points, I guess, for us of operational up-leveling.
Can I ask, Wade, it's a little bit more personal, but you also have to scale as a leader with the scaling org.
Sure.
Have there been elements of the leadership scaling for you that you found particularly challenging?
And area that has been a constant learning for me is just around my own sort of ability to lead like larger and larger groups of people. And then in particularly, like how do you hire great executives that can also lead those great groups of people? So I have not encountered anything harder in my career than like hiring great executives. Any CEO who tells you that's not at least in their top two, like I would be like, really? What are your top challenges?
I love it. How many direct reports do you have today?
Today I have six, I think. So, you know, I'm doing pretty good right now, but there's been, you know, even as early as late last year, I had like 14 or something like that. So
14 is too much, my friend.
Yeah, it's not, that's not ideal. You know, you sort of take that on in moments when it's sort of necessary, but it's definitely not your happy spot.
We spoke about remote there and kind of staying on the theme of geo-agnosticism, really. Like, you know, you started outside the Bay. You've also operated within it. And again, leaning on Jay Simons' brilliance from Bond and Atlassian, he asked, what do you feel you gained and lost from the different locations and approaches?
You know, I think we've always just tried to borrow from the best. Our sort of Missouri Midwest roots, there's like a sort of self-reliance, there's a pull yourself up by your bootstraps like mentality and attitude that has served us well. Like, we knew that to be successful, we were going to have to do that work ourselves and get it done. And then we were sort of instilled that into the culture. And so there's like a very down-to-earth, salt-of-the-earth humbleness that you find inside of Zapier that I think is pretty rare for most like Silicon Valley companies. I think also having operated inside of Silicon Valley, like, we've tried to sort of borrow some of the ambition that you find in companies there. Like, I think you don't necessarily get that in the Midwest. And so we've tried to like find things that we like from each and say like, hey, these things are the good parts, and then sort of jettison the things that we think are not so helpful. I think it was Bruce Lee has like his fighting technique is something like that, which is, you know, hey, borrow the stuff that's good and then throw away the rest of it. His sort of fighting style is this hybrid of a bunch of different things. And I've always just like thought that that was like a really good mental model for anything that you do, is to not get sort of overly fixated on a particular playbook, but instead just say, hey, there's some elements in here that really resonate and feel good to me. And then most of the rest of this is just kind of not relevant.
Can I ask, when you look at the kind of company landscape today and look at companies that you maybe borrow from most, aspire to most, respect most in terms of like, you know, behaviors, org structures, design, you know, like mine would probably be Amazon and Basecamp. Are there certain ones where you're like, that's fascinating and I draw a lot of learnings from them?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few, you know, Amazon is certainly a company that I admire a lot from afar. Stripe, I think, is one of the best sort of modern companies. Atlassian is one that I've sort of respected a lot from afar. Basecamp as well. Outside of sort of maybe traditional tech, like Disney is a company I think that is like, its durability and its ability to reinvent itself over and over again is like amazing to watch. So, you know, I think there's a lot of companies that you sort of try and learn from.
Totally with you. Final one for the funding discussion, which I'm excited for, naturally as a VC. But I do have to ask you, you mentioned like the soul of the earth, the pull your socks up. I'm a big believer in also like vulnerability too within organizations. How do you think about vulnerability for yourself as a leader?
Well, I tend to think that it is pretty useful to just be honest about like the situations you're in. I think that there's this sort of like old school mentality where people are like, I'm the leader, I have to be perfect. You know, I have to have all the answers. I have to get it right 100% of the time, or else I'll be letting my team down or look weak in front of them. I actually think that that prevents a lot of good things from happening inside of your company. And so I think the more that you can sort of get comfortable sharing like the full extent of the problem. Now, sometimes for a variety of reasons, you can't be 100% transparent, but to the extent you can say, hey, this is what we're up against, this is what we're dealing with, this is what we're trying to solve, it just gets everybody more aligned in like what we're trying to achieve and what we got to do, and it helps people understand and relate. When you talk about vulnerability, like, to me, that's the trick, is it's about saying, this is what the problem looks like 100%. This is the part that I'm excited about. This is the part I'm worried about. This is the part that like, I just don't know how we're going to get this done. And it gives everybody the ability to sort of use their whole brain, I guess, on solving the problem rather than like hiding this thing over here to the side because you're worried about whatever, the optics of looking weak or something.
Speaking of kind of the vulnerability around the decisions one makes, the other thing that I do have to ask while I have the chance is like, you know, decision making is a passion point of mine. How do you think about head versus heart when decision making? And also, what do you do when you just don't know?
I think for head decisions, like when you're trying to figure out like what's going to generate the most customer happiness or what's going to be, you know, the right products to go into or the right markets to go into, you generally like want to follow like your head. You want to do your assessment and like dig in and like understand what works, what doesn't work. When it comes down to sort of things that are more like moral or ethical or like personal, I guess, you know, there's an aspect of like, you got to just stay true to who you are and to yourself. The times where I find myself using my heart the most are times when you sort of come to this crossroads where you're at a decision where you're like, I just don't know what the answer is, but I have this like gut instinct or belief that this is right. And I have always found that when I don't go with my gut, I regret it in those instances. I want to be able to wake up at the end of the day and say, you know, I felt this way, I tried it this way, and if it didn't work, well, at least I did what I believed in. When I haven't done that, I'm like, well, what if I would have done it the way way that I thought originally. Like, I always have that question mark in the back of my head. So I generally, I guess, come back to the heart in those types of situations.
Listen, as a rom-com and a Hugh Grant fan, I always go back to the heart. So I'm thrilled to hear that from you. I do want to ask you, Nick, we spoke about kind of learnings and lessons from the Valley and then also not. When in the Valley, funding is very central to a lot of founders' mindsets in a lot of respects. And, you know, you chose a very different route, obviously. And so raising one round of funding since 2012, which is an anomaly, let's just say, when I look at my past guests. But I do have to ask, like, why, when everyone else around you was raising large sums, did you feel that that approach was not optimal?
Well, this is where I think a lot of founder CEOs just get bought into the hype and don't actually do their own assessment of this stuff. This is a thing that I just feel the VC community is just so good at marketing and selling itself that it is really hard to resist that temptation. And one of the things I like to, when I get a chance to talk to like groups of early stage founders, I say, look, you're not raising money. You are selling a part of your company. That's what you're doing. And be honest with yourself about what you're actually doing here. And make sure that when you're selling a part of your company, that you're getting what you hoped you would get out of it. Don't do it because of a reason that isn't true to you. And so you need to dig in and say, you know, if I gave up 20% of my company for $10 million or whatever, is that $10 million going to advance my mission and advance my cause in a way that I feel is worth that? Because down the line, that 20% is going to be worth a lot more than $10 million. And so you better be sure that you can turn that $10 million into something much, much better for yourself. And I see a lot of companies go out and just like taking these war chests and like selling all those parts of the company only just to sit on the cash and never do anything with it, or to go spend it in ways that aren't accretive to the business, when they should be sitting down and saying, and literally get the spreadsheet out and go like, okay, here's what we think is going to actually generate growth for our company. Here's how we think we can go from A to B, and do that assessment. If that dictates go raise money, great, go do it. If that doesn't, then don't do it. But don't do it because someone like you came along and said, oh my gosh, you're a great CEO. I think you're going to be the next Jeff Bezos or the next Bill Gates or whatever, and just like talks you into how awesome you are. Like, if that's the reason you're doing it, like, you're just selling yourself short, I think.
Wade, you've always turned down my money. You don't have to rub it in, okay? But I do have to ask, like, you know, the cost of capital today is so low for founders. Like, bluntly, valuations are so low.
It's not zero, though.
It's not zero. Zero, but it's freaking low. And my point is, like, there's the trade-off of time and, like, actually minimal dilution now, where, like, it's not 25% of old. It's 10%. It's 8%. I mean, Stripe raised 600 at 95. I mean, the dilution is nil. So I guess my question is, does your thoughts change at all when the cost of capital is so low?
You know, it still comes back to, like, what are you going to do with that capital? What do you need it for? How are you going to spend it? If you have a good answer for it, yes, right now, the cost of capital is incredibly cheap, especially if you're a good company. I think it's different if you're a struggling company, but if you're doing really well, it is a really good time compared to most to raise money. However, the entire existence of my company, like, the markets have only gotten better and better and better. Now, I'm not saying that's going to be always the case, but like, I've heard that every single year that this company has been in existence, each time it just gets better and better. And the options for raising capital, options for taking on debt or taking other instruments to fund your company have gotten more and more diverse. So just come back to, like, do you want it or not? You know, I think just so you have it is kind of a weak argument. And I think if you have a good balance sheet already, you know, if your balance sheet is sufficient for your goals, why do you need 10x your balance sheet? Why do you need 100x your balance sheet? So, like, just get really clear about what it is you want to achieve and what do you want to go do? Because that equity, I guarantee it, if you're a good company, that equity is going to be worth so much more down the line.
What did you gain by not doing that route?
We gained so much more freedom and flexibility. So many founders spend so much time engaged in the fundraising process. That is a huge mental and time investment that you have to commit to. And so for us, we never had to do any of that. That all was founder energy poured right back into helping our customers and growing our business. What better way to grow your business than to pour your time into growing your business versus this other part, which is selling your business? So, like, that's, I think, what it just boils down to.
I totally get you in terms of that time investment and what it means for you to be able to invest that back in the business, not in fundraising. But, you know, when I spoke to Jay before, he did say that you kept and maintained great relationships with ECs despite never raising primary or not raising it for a long time. So how do did you approach the relationship building process with VCs, and what did that look like for you?
Yeah, so, you know, I think despite what you've heard me say here on this podcast, like, I did say, like, hey, I do want an option. I do want to be in this situation where if I do say yes, hey, more funds would be better, like being able to take on more capital would be accretive to Zapier. I did want to be in a position where we could do that quickly. And so I just sort of set up a like simple calendar where I said, you know, hey, one Friday every quarter, I'm going to like go snag lunch with somebody, or I'm going to jump on a Zoom call with somebody and build a relationship with five or six people that I think are smart, talented, maybe potential partners. And such that if that day comes, I don't have to go through this shotgun wedding to raise money. I can know that if I'm looking for a partner in a business, this is a person that I already know that I want to do it. And they're willing to cut me a check on the spot.
How did you select those five or six people? Was it brand? Was it knowledge? Was it prestige? What were the determinants?
You know, mostly it was individuals, just like people I happened to meet and get, you know, introductions to and build some of that personal assessment of like, it's like hiring a person. It's like, is this person like going to be helpful to us over time? And you know, the ones that I did feel like I would find myself doing a repeat calls with them, maybe a couple times a year. People that I just didn't feel like we had that, I was like, hey, it's good to meet you, but I just didn't follow up with them otherwise.
No, I totally get you. We mentioned the primary capital element there. Secondaries are becoming more and more a prominent part of our ecosystem, which I think is a great thing. I'm a big advocate for secondaries. How did you approach secondary sales, Wade?
You know, I generally think that particularly for founders in particular, like having a little secondary generally is a good thing. When you run a company for a long time, you tend to not pay yourself super well. You take on a certain like personal finance debt. And so at some point in time, when your company is in like really good shape, you know, taking a little bit of money off the table in a secondary is like, I generally think the risk reward equation there is probably pretty reasonably smart. You know, I think even, you know, like the Basecamp crew did this, who is like, I think even more sort of anti VC than I am, right? So I generally think it's like just a sort of smart thing to say like, hey, I'm in a position where I can sort of set myself up, set my family up and not have to worry too much is helpful to your business, because now you can take bigger bets, take bigger swings, not worrying too much about how that's going to blow back on your personal situation.
The question I get from a lot of founders is, how do I know how much is the right amount to take off the table? What will piss people off? And so I guess the question is like, how do you think about determining the right amount to take off the table and what your thoughts are there?
I don't know that I've ever had this challenge because like I live a pretty like pedestrian lifestyle. And so the amount that I would take off the table is something that most people would just be like, are you sure you don't want more, Wade? So like, I don't know that I'm the right person to answer this question.
Would you take 10 million off the table?
I haven't. So I don't need that much money, like to sort of live a good lifestyle, I think is sort of what it boils down to.
Yeah, I have a very expensive mother, so we have different worlds.
You know, and this is where I think it just comes down to like, you know, what kind of lifestyle do you want to live? Like, what is your sort of personal goals for yourself? I don't fault anyone who has the opportunity to take more off who wanted that, you know, but for me, like, I really love what I'm doing with Zapier. I love what we're building. I want to see my ownership and the value of that ownership keep increasing over time. Like, I believe so much in it. I just am like, you know, I feel really good with a smaller amount of money.
Listen, I totally get it. And then final question before we dive in. As I said, a big rom-com fan, and you mentioned your wife before the show. How did you guys meet? What's the love story there?
We're high school sweethearts.
Love it. Listen, Wade, I want to dive into a quick fire round now. So I say a short statement and you give me your immediate thoughts. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
So what's the favorite book and why?
I'll just have to go like growing up, like that Harry Potter series stuck with me. It's something my wife and I like read together. We watched some movies together. Like I'm hopeful to like share that with my daughters. So I guess I'll go with that.
You mentioned daughters there. What three traits would you most want your children to adopt?
I hope they care about people. I hope they care about, you know, the fellow humans or the earth we live on. I hope they're hard workers. And I hope they're honest and good, I guess, sort of at its core.
What's the hardest element of your role with Zapier today?
I think it's just like keeping up with the growth, like just making sure that we're on top of everything always.
How did you arrive at your first pricing model? I hear there's a fun story.
We were debating back and forth late one night, might have been 1 or 2 a.m. before we launched, and all three of us had a bunch of thought leadership on pricing, and we were arguing back and forth on like, oh, it should be 3 columns or 4 columns, or it should end with a 9, or no, it shouldn't in for the nine. And I think there was a moment, I forget who, but one of us realized how pointless this argument was. It was a bunch of non-experts sort of trying to pretend to be experts. And so we sort of said, screw it. We're going to do our first pricing model based on the Fibonacci sequence. And so our plans were $11, $23, and $58. And then we named them amps, ohms, and volts, sort of like riffing on the Zap theme a little bit. So that's what our sort of first pricing plans look like.
I love that. And I didn't know that. Tell me, what was the last time your mind was blown by something? And what was that thing?
I mean, this happens a lot. So I'll tell you one that is on my mind recently is, so we actually just acquired this company, MakerPad, and Ben, the founder over there, one of the things that like got him on my radar is he would just post these tutorials on like how to build clones of these like pretty major tech apps. Like he built like an Airbnb clone and like some of these other things using no code tools. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Like this is incredible. Like he is pushing the envelope farther than anyone else has pushed what is possible with these tools. And so that certainly was perhaps not the most recent time, but it is an area that has blown my mind.
What aspect of leadership are you most insecure about today?
I think for me, I like to be liked, I think a little too much. And so it sometimes, I think, holds me back from like making decisions that need to be made.
I'm totally with you. That is an ongoing challenge for me. So I think we have that in common.
I wish I didn't have this insatiable need to be liked.
Anyway, final one. What are the next 5 years for you and for Zapier? Is there an IPO on the horizon?
You know, for us, our goal is to democratize automation. We want to make this stuff a lot easier for folks. I think the way most people talk about automation, it's this scary thing that happens to you. But we believe that automation can be for you. And if you make it easy enough, it can be a tool that anyone, no matter their job type that they're in, can make their lives easier, make their work easier. And so that is our commitment, is to really make this stuff way more accessible. So you're just going to see us laser focused on that.
Wade, I've so enjoyed this. Thank you so much for me going so completely off schedule with most of my questions, but genuinely this has been so much fun, so thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Harry.
I mean, I just love that discussion, and Wade was just incredibly patient with me with my questions. What a journey it is. I mean, my word, 1.4 million to 140 million in ARR. Incredible to see. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, of course you can on our site, the20minutevc.com. I love to see you there. But before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll. And for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just starting out or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Learn more at carta.com. And finally, I've always been a massive history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more VC funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that are bound to arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check them out at CooleyGo.com. As always, I cannot thank you enough for your support, and we've got some amazing, amazing shows for you next week.